Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with
Anthony McCarthy. Great to be here, Mark.
Always.
It's a busy 2 hours. We got a lot on the table.
A lot on the table here today. We're going to, as you know, this Wednesday is our 7th annual Annapolis Summit to be held in Annapolis at St. John's College, 7:30 to 9:30 a.m. at St. John's College. We're inviting all of you to come down. We'll be having a conversation in that first hour with our Governor Martin O'Malley and then the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House to talk about the coming session as the leaders of those two legislative bodies and of the State House. And we look forward to having you there. Part of that conversation will also, by the way, be streamed live on WEAA and streamed live on the BBJ Baltimore Business Journal website. It'll be aired live here on WEAA as we are in Annapolis. Later in the day, it'll be aired again on this program, and it'll be aired on WSCL-STL on the Eastern Shore later that day as well. And but we invite you all to come down and log on to steinershow.org and go to the Annapolis Summit icon on our website and sign up and join us. We look forward to having you there. And remember, we have that special offer that anybody who is a WEAA member is our guest. So please join us there. And in response to that, we also sent out invitations to all of the state legislative delegates and senators, during the course of that, we heard from folks in Senator Alan Kittleman's office, who is a Senate minority leader, who represents District 9 in Carroll and Howard counties, and Senator Nancy Jacobs, who is a Maryland Senate minority whip, and she represents from Cecil and Harford County, District 34. And they wanted to join us today for the first part of our program to talk about the Republican response or the Republican perspective on our budget crisis and where we should go. And Senator Kittleman, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's nice to be here. Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And Happy New Year to you.
And Happy New Year to you, too. And I understand that Senator Jacobs will be here momentarily.
Good.
Let's begin and talk about what you think is going to happen in this legislative session and your take on how we need to handle this $2 billion deficit that we face.
Well, first we need to realize it's actually a $3 billion deficit.
Okay.
I sit on the Spending Affordability Committee, and the budget analysts, when they came before us, acknowledged that they were including the $1 billion of federal stimulus that they assume we'll be having for next year, and we still had a $2 billion deficit. So they acknowledged that actually the deficit is $3 billion. And so we certainly face a daunting task here, but I think what we got to do is make sure we don't do it by raising taxes. I mean, that's one of the reasons we're in the situation we are today. I won't blame everything on our poor tax policy, but we certainly would be in better shape if we didn't raise taxes historically back in 2007. So I think we've gotten here by having bad budget policy, and we need to kind of turn that around to get out of it.
So what would your solution to this be? I mean, and what would be your perspective on how the state should address this? I mean, do we cut spending to schools? Do we cut spending for highways? What do we do?
How do we cut? This is Anthony McCarthy. Do we cut the state workforce? How in the world will we bring this gap and make it smaller and smaller?
Well, the problem is we could have done something before, and we didn't. And so we've exacerbated it by not doing anything when we solved the problems back in 2007 and 2008. That's the first thing. But what we have to do is we have to look at probably the programs that are the newest programs, the ones that have been developed since the new administration took over. Back in 2007, we raised taxes $1.5 billion, but we also raised spending at the same time hundreds of millions of dollars. We probably have to go back and look at that. We expanded Medicaid at the time. We definitely can't afford it, and so we should probably scale back what we did back then. I think we just need to just not spend as much. We have revenue. I think there's a misnomer out there that we are actually spending less now than we spent in the past, and that's not true. What's happening is that we just continually want to spend more. If we would simply just spend the same amount we spent last year, we would be better off. But the problem is there's expectations out there that we're going to spend more money, and we just need to say that we can't spend more than we have.
So the question would be then, what do you creatively do to alter the budget, which some of the questions we'll be asking the governor and the Senate president and the speaker on Wednesday. So what do we do to do something more creative, if that's the way to go? Or, you know, right now the governor's called in the heads of all of the school systems to say prepare for cuts. And we read today in the paper that I think Senator Jacobs is with us. Senator, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Here.
Thank you. And I was about to say, in the senators in your district, Senator Jacobs, we heard today that teachers are going to be asked, and people in the Harford County school system are being asked to take a 2% cut in salary. So what is that? I mean, how is that to be made up? Is that to be accepted? Is there another way to address this?
Well, let me just go ahead and respond.
Go ahead, please.
No, we have to. I mean, there's no way that we can handle the overspending without having everybody take some of the hurt. And, you know, I think that, you know, I've talked to my Democratic colleagues, and frankly, you know, we are a very small minority in the state Senate. Senator Jacobs and I lead a Republican caucus of 14 members out of 47. So, you know, we're certainly not going to be the ones who are calling the shots down there. But, you know, it certainly would be our suggestion that we look at everything. And the members of the Democratic Party that I've talked to in my Senate body have told me that they just don't think we can leave education completely alone, that, you know, something that's so much part of our budget, you know, has to be considered. And especially for local governments, you know, Mark, we've told local governments that they need to cut some of their budgets as well and take reductions from the state. And over a half of their budget, for example, where I live in Howard County, 60% of our budget is the school system. To tell them that they can't even look at that, it's just not possible for them to make the reductions necessary. So I think what we have to do is put everything on the table. What the Republicans would like to do is be included in the discussions on how to deal with this. Like I said, in 2007, as mentioned earlier, we had a budget amendment that would have tried to rectify some of these problems back when we saw the recession coming. That was not accepted by the other side. Now they continuously have these fiscal leader meetings, and they don't include any Republicans in them whatsoever. It's my understanding that Senate President Miller would be willing to allow a member of the Republican caucus who serves on the budgets committees to attend, but has been told by Speaker Bush that he does not want any Republicans from the House attending, so therefore the Senate President doesn't have any of us attend. I mean, that's that kind of problem or that kind of policy that makes these problems, because they completely shut out a third of the legislature.
I think we should bring Senator Jacobs into this conversation. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Senator Jacobs. This is Anthony McCarthy. I want to ask you, you know, a great deal of talk about taking taxes off the table, looking at strategic cuts, as Senator Kettleman just shared with us, and that a lot of things will be on the table. What if we flip that? You probably remember during Governor Ehrlich's term, there was a great deal of conversation about fees that were being raised. Whether we were talking about some of our MBA fees, we were talking about some of our college fees. Is that on the table? Can we look at maybe raising some of these dollars to close this gap in additional fees, not taxes?
Well, of course, he's already been doing that. If you look back at the 2007 special session, he did that. He raised...
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. He raised the motor vehicle taxes. He raised... the fees on the registration. He's already pretty much raised an awful lot of fees. So, are there other fees that he could probably find to raise? I'm sure he's looking. I know that in the past they wanted to have expand the sales tax to include more services. There was an Ernst & Young report back in 2007 that was done for the Maryland Chamber of Commerce about the effects of tax hikes on jobs in the state of Maryland. And that report found that raising the sales tax by the 20% it did would cost about 950 jobs per every $100 million in new tax revenue. And they also found that raising the corporate income tax from 7 to 8%, which is what they did, would cost over 1,700 jobs for every million tax revenue. And, you know, then they went on and raised the personal income tax to 6% for small businesses and individuals filing over 500,000.
Well, let me just ask you all this question, though. I mean, and I hear what you're saying, Senator, and one day I'd love to have you on with some others that we will during the session to just debate those facts. I mean, because I think there are arguments to be had on both sides there. But my question would be, what would you do? What would you say to the people of Maryland, what would you say to the people of Harford County, or the people of Cecil or Carroll County, Howard County, about what you intend to do, what we should do? I mean, it's one thing not to be in power.
Right.
But clearly Republicans want to be in power.
Well, as Senator Kittleman said, we would like a place at the table. And in the past, it was Senator Stolfus a couple years ago that offered some really good, very specific amendments with much of our ideas in them, and that was totally ignored. I think if we have a place at the table, we can work on those things together. But, you know, the Democrats got us into this. And I think the Democrats are going to have to find the way to get it out of this. Now, if they include us, you know, we would love to be a part of that and offer our suggestions. But, you know, and what we just said, that didn't even include how many jobs were lost because of living wage laws, tobacco tax increases, or any of the other taxes or fees that Governor O'Malley raised. And if you look at what Senator Kittleman was also talking about with education, I agree. And I know that David Craig, my county executive in Harford County, agrees. Is over 60% of almost every county's budget.
So how do you tell the teachers in Harford County that they have to take a 2% wage cut?
Well, how do you tell the state workers that they're getting furloughed and that they'll probably get furloughed again and that many of them may be losing their jobs? You know, we are all in this together as a state, and I don't like it. None of us like it. We don't want to see anybody lose any jobs, but I think this is something that Marylanders are going to have to tighten their belts, and we're going to have to help each other, and we're all going to have to come to the table and do our fair share.
Also, Mark and Anthony, I think it's also important to realize that as the minority party, we have very little staff provided to us in Annapolis. The Democratic majority has tremendous amounts of people who can go through budgets for them, can give them suggestions, can look at different areas. I have one full-time person and one part-time person, and I can go through the best I can. I don't sit on a budget committee, but myself and Senator Jacobs and the other and the members on the budget committee can go through as best we can. But it's difficult to ask us to pinpoint places right now when we don't have the staff that even help us.
But Senator Kittleman, don't you have the same committee staff? Do you share committee staff with the majority?
No.
Okay.
Committee staff works for the chairman of the committees, and the chairman of committees, frankly, when they're making their decisions, have smaller groups that sit in the back room and make decisions before they come out and make the final vote. That's one of the biggest problems in Annapolis, and I think a lot of people in the state don't realize it, is how much is done behind closed doors, how much is done without the public input. We saw that in the special session in 2007 when all of a sudden we had a computer services tax when it was never had a public hearing and never had any testimony whatsoever.
You know, we've had members sitting in committee, Republican members sitting in committee, and they hand out amendments. And Republicans have never seen these amendments, and they talk about them like they've been on the table and they've been talking about them for weeks. And the Republicans never saw them before. You know, and they had no intention of giving them to us. You know, that's the way it works in Annapolis. And it's extremely unfortunate because I think we have a lot of good ideas that we could bring to the table. We want to partner and help solve these problems. We really, truly do.
This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with Anthony McCarthy. We're talking with two of the leaders of the Maryland State Senate, Republican leaders of the Maryland State Senate. You just heard Senator Nancy Jacobs, who is the Senate Minority Whip. Senator Alan Kittleman with us, who is the Senate Minority Leader. We want you to join us here at 410-319-8888 to bring your thoughts to the table, questions for the senators, and what they're raising here. I mean, I think you raised some interesting and valid points about lack of inclusion, which I'm sure we'll bring up with the Democratic leadership on Wednesday at our Annapolis Summit and to see what their response is to that. So what do you think about what that says to the state of Maryland, what you think the state of the state is in terms of our politics? We see, is it George Owens? I have that name right?
Yeah,
George Owens,
former
secretary in Governor Ehrlich's cabinet, who is running against Martin O'Malley in the primary. And
Delegate. He was one of the Democrat leaders in the House. I served with him there.
And he's making a run as a conservative Democrat in that primary. And then, of course, we've heard a great deal from Governor Ehrlich, and many people expect him to challenge Governor Martin O'Malley once again. So tell us about your thoughts on that and what you see as the future of politics in Maryland. What do you see coming up in 2010?
Well, Mark and Anthony, I've been traveling around the state, as Senator Jacobs has, and there's tremendous dissatisfaction with the way in which things are happening in Annapolis. Dissatisfaction in a governor and a legislature that simply doesn't seem to be in tune with everybody. I mean, we've been having these problems with the recession, and now, unfortunately, the governor has finally come to the party and wants to focus on jobs, jobs, jobs. But, you know, there was no focus on that for the last two or three years. And so I think what I'm hearing from people is a real disheartened feeling about Annapolis. And, And this, and it goes down to everybody in Annapolis. They're upset at Republicans, even though I don't necessarily think that's valid, but they're upset at everybody because they just feel like we're not listening to them. And
well,
I think that it's going
to
be an interesting
to say
part.
About jobs, 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 all you have to do is look at what he's done to businesses in Maryland the last couple of years. I mean, Hilton Hotels chose Virginia over Maryland last year. Black & Decker moved their headquarters to Connecticut. And these are just the bigger companies. I mean, we're losing tens of thousands of jobs because of the anti-business attitudes and a policy that we have here in Maryland that faces the highest unemployment rate in 25 years. I mean, that's not acceptable. He should have been looking at job years ago, and we might not have been in the situation as badly as we are now.
So I want to ask about that political environment. What will be the other message? In Maryland, Senator Jacobs, I've known her for many years and an incredibly talented leader in the legislature. But oftentimes, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. Oftentimes, Republicans in the state of Maryland get caught in the, I guess, the more conservative social message of the national Republicans when Maryland tends to be a much more moderate state. There are certainly conservatives in our state. But how will you speak to those independent voters who are so important in this very difficult economic time that will make them look at the Republican Party and say this is a viable option going forward?
Mark, the legislation that I have been passing the past few years deals with gang issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's not Republican or Democrat. And I would hope that people wouldn't think that putting child sex offenders behind bars has to do with Republican or Democrat. You know, I had as many or more Democrat sponsors on my Jessica's Law bill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not a time. We're not playing those kind of social partisan politics. You'll not see any of us having any kind of legislation in that deals with that. Right now, our focus, my focus in particular, because I feel so strongly about it, and I was the sponsor of Jessica's Law, is, of course, getting more strict laws on the books. So the things like the tragedy that happened in Salisbury, that man should still be in jail. He should have never been out of jail. And, you know, those are some of the areas that I'm interested in, as well as the gang. I'm not on the budget committee, but we have plenty of members who are, and we'll be working extremely hard on those issues as well. And you know, Senator Kittleman's on the Finance Committee. I don't think you're seeing, and you haven't seen the past few years, a lot of ultra-conservative things come out of the Republican Party. I think we're the mainstream, I believe, of more of America than we've ever gotten credit for.
Hey, Anthony, the people of Maryland are concerned about their jobs.
Yep.
They're concerned about how they're going to pay their bills. They're concerned about their electricity prices. They're concerned about their oil prices. They're concerned about what things cost in the grocery store. Those are things that we're concerned about with, too. Republicans have always been maintained that what holds our party together is our fiscal conservatism. That's the most important thing to the Republican Party, and that's the issue that's before the voters this November. They're more concerned about the well-being of their family and the quality of life that they have because of the economic budget policies that they've faced over the last 3 years.
Absolutely.
So that's the issues that we're going to be discussing. That's what we're going to be focusing on. And not because we want to focus on it, but it's because that's what the people of Maryland want us to focus on.
Let me open the phone here as we talk with two of the Republican leaders of the Maryland State Senate. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Christy in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. How are you doing?
Well, welcome.
Thank you, Christy.
Good. I have a comment and a question.
Sure.
My comment is, I just recently started a petition, and I live in Baltimore City. I just started a petition to find a way, or a recommendation, I guess you would say, to help this budget crisis not only in our city, but in our state. I happen to live down the street from the police commissioner of Baltimore City, Commissioner Bofeld, and I noticed that he has police guards 24/7 outside that house. I did a little run around just by myself. I understand that you two were saying you don't have staff, but just by myself, I put together about $2 million that we're paying just for the police commissioner and the mayor to be protected. I found out that there's more people than that, at least 8 people in Baltimore City. I don't know for sure, but I would assume the same thing is replicated in the county. So that's a quick way, just on my little week worth of going by myself, that that's $2 million that we could save, at least in Baltimore City, but I'm pretty sure it's more than that. So I just wanted you guys to comment on that. And my question, which I truly don't know the answer to, is when was the last time that a pay raise was given to you guys in Annapolis? That could be another way. If the hurt needs to be spread around, I would say that's one way to help spread it. Thank you guys very much.
Hey, Chrissy, thank you very much for your question. And I can tell you there is a recommendation for a pay raise for legislators that's coming out of an independent commission that it's my understanding the Republican caucus certainly opposes that. We think there's no way that we should have a pay raise with this economic climate and with people in Maryland hurting. And so we're certainly going to say no to that. But I've also heard that the Senate
totally
President and the Speaker of the House have also agreed that they're going to say no. And so we will not have a pay increase, I don't see. We've had our pay frozen for the last 4 years already. So the legislators are not looking for a pay raise, certainly not the Republican legislators, and I completely agree. And when I served on the Howard County Council before I came to the state Senate, I voted to freeze the salaries on the Howard County Council back from 2002 to 2006. So I think it's very important that we make sure that we sacrifice as well as the other folks in Maryland.
Well, and Alan Christie's absolutely right. A lot of the top-level officials have round-the-clock security, or at least, you know, partial security around the clock. And she's right. That's probably an area that some people in Maryland would like to see have it be cut.
You don't think public leaders like mayors and governors should have security details?
Not as much as what they do have. For example, you know, when our governor travels overseas, he brings several security detail with him. I'm sorry. The governor's not probably in face of great danger when he goes to Ireland to play or to go and visit people in Ireland. I think that's one place where the citizens of Maryland are entitled to say, we don't want to spend our money there. We'd rather spend it on, you know, paying our teachers and helping those who are developmentally disabled. We don't want to pay to have five or six people travel over there with the governor while he goes to Ireland.
Put those police officers on the street where they're needed.
Yeah.
So with what you just said, Senator Kinnaman, does that mean that you do not think that teachers, as teachers will in Harford County, have to take a 2% cut in their pay?
No, they may have to. Well, all I'm saying is it's very difficult for me to go to a teacher and say, we need you to take a less pay, when I know that, as Christy brought out, that we have elected officials, we have public officials who have these pretty large, frankly, security details to protect them, when I really am not so sure they need to have that large of a security detail. And if she's right, it's not just the state government, it's not just the city government, the counties are the same way. My home county, the county executive has security, which, you know, last time I heard, the county executive of Howard County is not having too many death threats.
Yeah, I don't know that our county executive in Harford County has security.
I don't know either. I can't answer that question.
I don't think he does. When I've seen him places, he might come along with his assistant, but he's never come along with security.
I mean, the county executive in Howard County has a driver. A police officer drives him everywhere.
Oh, Harford County, David Craig does not.
Yeah.
410-319-88.
Harford County is more of a Republican county.
That may not be a Republican or Democratic issue either. I'm sure there are a lot of people who have executive protection who are Republicans and Democrats in this state. I'm sure Governor Ehrlich had his protection.
Yeah. Well, Montgomery County executive had a private bathroom built for security purposes a few years ago. I'm not sure. You know, maybe he was afraid to go to the bathroom by himself. I don't know.
410-319-8888. Isaiah, you're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, Mark.
Good evening, Isaiah.
Every time they talk about the budget, they want to cut education. What about the future of the kids? You know, you cut education, then they say crime rises. Crime rises because the high school dropout rate rises. Leave education alone. Freeze the wages of all of these people who are supposed to be helping the state. A sprinkle of people make a decision for everyone in the state. What about we the people? Give the people a break for a minute, and I'll listen to you off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, Isaiah, I have not said I want to cut education. What I've said is that the Democratic leaders that I've talked to have said that they don't see a way of getting out of this budget problem without having some reductions in education because it's such a large part of our budget. And I certainly agree with you. An education is certainly an important thing to for our children to be able to be successful in life. And my four children have all gone to public schools or are still in public schools. And I went to public schools. It's very, very important to me. But when you talk about crime, it's not simply education. We've certainly found that it's mostly a societal issue. It's not simply an education issue. And so that's a much bigger issue to tackle than simply say that if we had better education.
Yeah,
but I am not promoting cutting
very,
education.
Very large emphasis on education, or we wouldn't be spending 60% of the budget. We know how important it is, and I can assure you, we hate every single cut that has to be made to anybody.
We're about to run out of time, but I want to ask both of you, Senator Jacobs and Senator Kittleman, as we go into this election year, will there be opportunities for you to reach across the aisle and work with Democrats to solve these big problems? Or do you think because we're in election year, there's going to be even more isolation than usual?
Well, I think actually the Democratic leadership is very worried about the climate out there in Maryland. And so I would hope that they would come to us. You would think that that would be the best thing to do, is to show that you want to find a bipartisan solution. The problem is, in Maryland, we've had such one-party rule for so long that they're just not used to it. And they just like to do things on their own. They don't like to include the Republicans. So it's frankly not something that I get to determine. I have certainly worked with Democrats on issues in my 5 years in the state Senate. And there are an awful lot of issues that are not partisan by any means whatsoever. I mean, the great majority of our votes are not partisan. It's just the issues that come before us that are principles that we just differ with them.
I mean, I know that Senator Kittleman and I have, the last 2 years that we've been the leaders on the Republican Senate, have offered to come to the table and to help, but we've never been extended an invitation to do that.
Let's try to get some more calls in here. Julian in Woodstock, you're on the air. Hi, Julian, you're on the air.
Okay. Yeah, I have a pretty novel idea to save some money here. It's interesting that not only legislators at the local level, but nationally as well. When I vote for somebody, I vote for them to look out for my best interests. And when you talk about cutting budgets and stuff, you affect people's lives and they lose jobs and such. I've yet to hear one legislator at any time vote down a pay raise. It would be real interesting to me if they would accept their salary. I understand they got to get paid, but why not measure their salary against the median income of the constituents that they serve? And that not being much, that would cause them to work hard to improve situations as opposed to taking away from the folk that really have a bad economy.
I'm sorry, Julian, but you're getting a little garbled there, but I think we got the sense of what you're saying. Senator Kittleman, you want to grab that if you can answer it in like less than a minute?
Yeah, no, I certainly can. And Julian, I'll tell you, when I was on the Harrah County Council, the commission proposed an increase in salaries for council members, and I actually put an amendment in to freeze it for 4 years. So I did. Not only did I vote against the pay raise, I actually put in an amendment to force it to be frozen for 4 years. So you do have legislators who feel that way. And frankly, we should have a citizen legislature. We shouldn't have legislators who depend upon their salaries in the legislature for their full income.
So I bet you, my guess is that both of you would support the referendum that's coming up in November to ask for a constitutional convention of the citizens to debate the Maryland Constitution.
Well, that's a much bigger issue than just pay raise.
No, it certainly is. But I'm saying I imagine you both would support that idea.
I have not even thought of that right now. I know that it has to be on the ballot. I know that it has to be there. But,
it has to be there, right.
But, I mean, I'm not necessarily saying I'm for or opposed to it. You just got to be careful, because when you open up the Constitution, you can do an awful lot of things.
You can. We'll be debating that one.
Another thing we could be cutting is the bond bills. The last several years, Senator Kittleman and I have said, let's not do bond bills. We don't have the money. We shouldn't be doing that. And I think this session we both feel like, you know, let's take bond bills off the table. This is not a time to be putting extra money in.
Well, I'll tell you what, Senator Kittleman and Senator Jacobs, one thing I will promise, and Anthony and I will both promise this here, is as we create these debates on the air about the issues facing the state legislature, we will always turn to the two of you and others to be part of those debates.
Thank you very much. And one request, when
yes.
You ask them questions, don't ask them if they're going to raise taxes in 2010, because they'll say no, because it's an election year. Ask them if they're going to raise taxes in 2011. That's a better question.
I'll ask that on Wednesday.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Take care.
We appreciate the opportunity.
It's always
Thank
good to
you.
Talk to both of you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Senator Nancy Jacobs, who's the Maryland Senate Minority Whip. Senator Alan Kittleman is the Senate Minority Leader. And they joined us, a little advanced look at what they think before we talk to the governor, president of the Senate, the speaker of the House this Wednesday live in Annapolis at 7:30 a.m. We want you to be there as our guest to join that program. We're going to take a short break, come back with Sheldon Eiffel, talk about Senator Harry Reid and his comments. Some people think are racist. Are they or are they not? And more. So stay tuned for that. I'll remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. There's so much to talk about. We're not sure where to go next sometimes, but we got an interesting email from a woman who is often on our show and talks a great deal about many things in our society. I'm sure I'm talking about Sheldon Eiffel, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law and author of the book On the Courthouse Lawn. It's just a very compelling book about lynching and its effect on the 21st century, a story from right here in Maryland. She has written two really interesting pieces. One in theroot.com, and you can go there right now, go to our website and click on How American Idol Paved the Way for President Barack Obama, which is interesting. But we're going to start with her other article that she has written for Politico, which was Double Standard, What? About what happened with Harry Reid. And I'm, of course, here with my co-host on Mondays, Anthony McCarthy and Sheldon Eiffel. Welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Mark. I hope you can hear me.
We can. I know you're on your way to church.
Yep.
Which is a good place to be.
Yeah. Actually, it's a great program. We're having Michelle Singletary from the Washington Post, who's the financial advisor, doing a session on financial literacy, which we could all use a little bit more of. And
I could.
She's a great African-American woman who does a lot of really tremendous free advice for our communities about how to help ourselves financially and learn how to handle our money.
You know, for our listeners who may not have, I'm not sure if they, how they could have not been following the news in the last couple of days, Harry Reid is quoted in a brand new book that's come out as making some very provocative statements about candidate Barack Obama and the American people's ability to process the fact that he is African-American and be open to electing him to the White House. And he made reference to the fact that Barack Obama was light-skinned and that he did not speak with a Negro dialect unless he wanted to. And Sherilyn, you wrote a very compelling piece about just, I guess, condensing for us the difference between the comments that were made by Harry Reid, the current majority leader, because a lot of Republicans are comparing them to the remarks that were made by Trent Lott several years ago, which ultimately pushed him out of his majority leader slot in the United States Senate.
Well, what made me write the piece was, you know, the question up today was, you know, is this a double standard? Why is it that Trent Lott had to step down as the Senate then minority leader and Harry Reid doesn't have to step down as Senate majority leader? And, you know, I tried to remain calm and take issue with it, you know, on its merits, because these are the kinds of discussions that I think so often get obscured in our public debate. You know, people know, like, you know, there were two comments, both of them were about race, and therefore they must be the same, you know? And I wanted us to just slow down and be really careful about recognizing what precisely it is that Harry Reid said, some of which is problematic, some of which is, I frankly think, quite interesting, and what Trent Lott said. So I wanted to try and set the record straight in a very short commentary. And the gist of it, Anthony and Mark, was that, first of all, you know, it's important for people to remember what Trent Lott said. What Trent Lott said at a celebration honoring the birthday of Strom Thurmond, renowned South Carolina segregationist, racist, ran on the States' Rights Party. Many of us know, all while this was happening, had fathered a daughter out of wedlock with a black girl who worked in his home, a daughter he kept secret for decades. And what Trent Lott said at that public engagement was that when Strom Thurmond ran for president as a Dixiecrat on the States' Rights Party in 1948, a lot of us would have voted for you, and a lot of us voted for you, and this country would be a lot better off if you had won. So what Trent Lott was doing was waxing nostalgic and pining and longing for a world in which blacks would have had to remain under white supremacy by law. That's what Strom Thurmond wanted. That is completely different than what Harry Reid said in this very controversial book that's been published. And what Harry Reid said, which you just read, I think, you know, is interesting and problematic in a couple of ways. The substance of what he said, I think, is actually quite interesting, and I would love to talk about that. In the piece I wrote today, I talked about his use of the word Negro, and when he talked about Obama not speaking with a Negro dialect. And, you know, a lot of people were saying, you know, who uses the word Negro? It's such a terrible word. I don't advocate using the word Negro. I think it clearly shows that Harry Reid does not spend a whole lot of personal time around black people, which is really no surprise that the senator from Nevada does not. But the use of the word Negro is not the N-word. It is not a racial slur. It continues to be used on the U.S. Census. There was just a big story in the New York Times about it last week. The census insists on using it because they say that the last time they took the census, 50,000 black people, mostly elderly, preferred to continue to regard themselves as Negro. You know, it's a word that Justice Thurgood Marshall used until his death in 1993. So I don't approve of his use of the word, but it's not the N-word. And it's not the same as, you know, longing for the days when blacks would have lived under white supremacy by law.
So what do you think, this is being overdone then? I mean, because we hear so much and so many people who always use that the term articulate for anybody African-American who many people in the white community think speak, quote unquote, well. So
that's what was so great about, you know, really looking at what Harry Reid actually said. What he said is what most of us have thought and most of us know is true, that Barack Obama had electability among white voters because he did not present as a kind of regular, you know, Southern descended black candidate. His speaking voice is not Southern. His speaking voice does not carry the cadence of the community. The fact that he's, you know, light-skinned, maybe, certainly the fact that he doesn't have, a past that's rooted in slavery. You know, there are studies that show that voters do vote for people who look like them, that the more the candidate looks like them, the closer, the more affinity the voter feels for the candidate. So I don't think that Harry Reid said something that we don't all know is true. And those of us who, you know, have been educated at higher levels in white institutions know that when, you know, our colleagues come over to us and say, you are so articulate, what they mean is that you don't speak like a quote-unquote black person, what they think a black person speaks like. And what they mean by that is that you've got subject-word agreement, that your voice doesn't have a kind of Southern accent, and they think that's a compliment. So, yes, it is no surprise that the first black president of the United States would be one who appealed to white voters in that he had those mainstream attributes as Barack Obama does. And so Harry Reid was actually critiquing the white electorate. He was explaining why Barack Obama is electable. I don't approve of, you know, him using the word Negro, but the substance of what he was saying, I think we all recognize, was not untrue.
But Sherilyn, just to make an argument that a lot of folks believe that our political leaders, of course, they are certainly not infallible, but mm-hmm. should think before they speak.
Absolutely.
And that Harry Reid, if he is guilty of anything, and I think a lot of people, including the Congressional Black Caucus and other African-American leaders like Al Sharpton, have, you know, Al Sharpton took him to task a bit, like you did, on the word Negro. He said the man should be a little bit more exposed, and that would probably impact his use of language a little bit. But that they should be held to a different standard, that he should have thought.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the standard is he is being raked over the coals. He's got to do the apology tour, as Trent Lott did. I didn't say give the guy a pass.
Uh-huh.
He absolutely should have to do precisely what he is doing, which is, you know, mea culpa. I'm not sure I go as far as Doug Wilder and saying he has to apologize.
He has to apologize,
the country.
Yeah.
I don't know about that one, but I think he's doing his apology tour. He is going to be chastened by this. He does have to clean up his language. He is a public figure in a position of tremendous power at the head of a party that purports to have the interests of African Americans at heart. So one would hope that he would even know what are the terms by which we should be referred. So I you know, as I said, I'm not defending his use of the word Negro. I am simply saying you cannot equate what he said with what Trent Lott said. Trent Lott, by the way, also did the apology tour, but it's kind of a little bit harder to apologize for saying, wow, I wish Strom Thurmond had been elected president. I mean, what do you mean? Like, no, I didn't. I was lying when I said that, or I got caught up. I mean, whatever. The last thing that I will say about this, you know, the comparison to Trent Lott, and I said this in the piece, is that the delusion that Trent Lott had to step down as Senate Minority Leader because of the comments he made needs to be dealt with. Trent Lott had to step down as Minority Leader
right.
because he did not have the support of George W. Bush, who was the president. They wanted a Minority Leader who was on their team. That person that they wanted was actually Bill Frist. I think they came to probably regret that decision, but at the time, Trent Lott was regarded as too independent, and that's why when Lott made those comments, the president and his team were silent. And Trent Lott was deeply resentful of it. He talked openly about feeling abandoned by the White House, and that's why he had to step down, because the White House put basically the signal out that they were fine with Lott stepping aside so that they could have someone who was more on their team. That's the reason, not because of the comments that he made.
But, Mark, I want to ask you and Sherilyn, Michael Steele is absolutely incensed. He's called for Henry. He's called for the majority leader to resign. And he makes the point, and I want to get your thought on this, Mark and Sherilyn. He said, just think, this is the double standard. If a Republican had said exactly what Harry Reid said, there would be a different reaction, he believes, in the media and from Democrats. Mark, do you think that's true?
I like to hear what Sherilyn thinks, yeah. But I think he Republicans would be more pilloried than a Democrat.
Right, absolutely. And yeah, absolutely. You know why? Because when your record lines up with your words, then you should be subject to greater scrutiny. You should be subject to people being more suspicious of you and to not accepting your apology so you can keep your official position. Harry Reid has a record that backs him up. And so if he's voting for initiatives that are helpful to the African-American community as opposed to someone like Trent Lott, who is not, then it seems to me it makes perfect sense, or any Republican, particularly in this most recent Congress, then I think that you should expect that when your words of that nature line up with your substantive record, which is, after all, the most important thing, that you should expect that you're going to be subject to greater scrutiny. That's not a double standard. That's the difference between Republicans and Democrats.
The always very clear and insightful Sherilyn Leifel is with us on the air here, 410-319-8888. We're talking about the pieces she has written for Politico, and now about the piece she wrote for Root, which I find, at www.theroot.com, How American Idol Paved the Way for Barack Obama, which I found fascinating. But first, let's take a caller who wants to comment on this first part of our discussion. And John in Pikesville, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing?
Well,
hey, John.
Welcome.
I'm in my car. I'm riding home from work, and I didn't catch all the names of who are on the air, but can you tell me who the lady is speaking right now?
Sherilyn Leifel, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law.
Oh, man, she is so smart.
Yeah, we know that.
Yep, she really is.
I like you.
And she's quite articulate as well.
when I look at pundits on the air, and they're interviewing, you know, somebody like Steele, and they, you know, he makes his comments. There's nobody to say what she just said. I'm sitting there screaming to the TV, and I wish she could be on there because it squelches all of this. Like, you know what I mean? It's not even an argument. How can you compare what Trent Lott said to what, you know, what the man said, what Harry Reid said? It's not even on the same level. So I just want to applaud her, and that's all I call in to say is thank you.
John, thank you. Just tune in more often. You'll hear more of this on the air.
Thank you. Can I say something about the Michael Steele piece? Because honestly, I mean, I'm looking at the time, and clearly we don't have enough time.
Go ahead, please.
Mark, you introduced me to Michael Steele. Mm-hmm. We did a show, Michael Steele and I, on the Mark Steiner Show when you were on another station that will remain nameless. the day the Supreme Court issued its decision in Bush.
I remember that show, yeah.
Right.
And I have to tell you, I have made something of a study of Michael Steele since then. And, you know, I'm thinking about writing an open letter to him to save him from himself. That Michael Steele would be the standard bearer on this set of comments to me is amazing. I'm sure that you all have seen Michael Steele's appearance on Fox News last week, in which he used the term honest engine to talk about retro racial terms of offense. Somebody on the route said, you know, the next thing he'd be doing is catching an N-word by the toe and putting them in the paddy wagon. talk about somebody who needs to update their language. You know, Michael Steele is a gaffe a minute, and that he would choose to be the standard bearer on this about someone saying something that is inappropriate really shows that I think he's just foundering in terms of trying to figure out what is his job supposed to be as Republican National Committee chairman. I think it's worth, you know, talking about on another show. I don't think it's worth talking about today. But, you know, I do think if you go online and you look at the comments that he made last week, it's actually just kind of almost amazing the audacity he has to actually be the person pressing this case about Harry Reid.
Let me open the phones again at 410-319-8888. If we don't get the second article, we'll have Sherilyn Ifill back on to talk about that, because I really love what you wrote about the American Idol. I think it's really very intriguing. Let us go to Phil. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Phil. Welcome.
Hi. I'd just like to respond to this whole Harry Reid situation, and I'm kind of amused by it. I'm amused by it because this is one of the few times I find myself forced to agree with Michael Steele and the Republicans. Here is a clear example of a double standard. This is clearly had this sort of thing been said by someone in the Republican Party, there would be outrage. And in fact, when something similar was said, there was outrage. You know, we talk about what Trent Lott said, and what Trent Lott said was what Trent Lott felt. And, you know, whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, it was an honest thing. He said what he felt. And apparently Harry Reid also said what he felt. And the difference is because, you know, we want his vote. We want his political clout. We're willing to bend over backwards to try to justify something which you know, clearly was inappropriate. We go through all these changes to avoid using certain words. I'm also amused that the word Negro is now out of fashion. You know, my father would have never referred to himself as anything other than a Negro. That was a term of respect during his generation.
Phil, you raised issues we touched on a bit in the beginning of the show, but I'd like to have let Sherilyn respond since you're on the air with us. Sherilyn?
Well, I did already. I'm sorry, I'm caller. I don't know if you heard my original comments, but I actually responded directly to your point about why it's different, and I won't repeat myself, but the substance of what they said is different. And actually, your last remark proves the point. The point I made is that the term Negro is one that is still used on the United States census because of people like your father or late father and many people who are elderly who continue to use that term. I mentioned the fact that Thurgood Marshall used that term until his death in 1993, including writing it in Supreme Court opinions. It is not a term I use or like. It is a term I think is inappropriate, but it is not the N-word. It is not a racial slur. And it certainly maybe reflects Harry Reid's racial insularity in that he clearly does not spend a whole lot of time with black people if he's still using that term. And it strikes me that that's problematic for a Senate majority leader. But I do not find it to rise to the level of Trent Lott, what you call feeling, about longing for, you know, a world in which Strom Thurmond and the States' Rights Party would rule. You said whether that's right or wrong. To my mind, that's wrong. I don't have a problem saying that that's wrong. That may be his feeling, but that's the way he feels, to me, that makes him inappropriate for high public office unless the Republican Party wants to today or at least in 2002 when he made those comments, embraced that. Obviously, they did not want to embrace it, so they left him twisting in the wind, and that's why he had to resign. It's not the same thing, it seems to me, as Harry Reid saying that Obama had certain built-in attraction to the white electorate, and that he could appeal to them in the way he spoke and his presentation. And I don't think the two are the same.
One last caller or two, if we can get them in before the end of the hour. And Dana in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for taking my call, and to Ms. Eiffel for your reminding us of history and facts, which is getting lost, I think, in some of the discussion about Senator Reid and former Senator Lott.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do appreciate your comments and what you've said. I want to go back and read your whole blog. My comments regarding Michael Steele, suffice it to say that I think he is using this opportunity to take away criticism from him, of him, that's coming from his own folks in the Republican Party. And I think he's seen this as yet another convenient opportunity to deflect attention from things that he's doing that aren't that smart in general. Thank you again for taking my call.
Thank you, Dana, so much.
Yeah, and thank you. I think Dana's absolutely right. Day before yesterday, the headlines on the front page of the papers was about Republicans basically calling for Michael Steele's head, saying somebody get him under control, angry about this book that he's published that purports to give the 10 steps to defeating Obama, which many in the Republican leadership did not know he was publishing. In that book, he actually offered some fairly honest assessments of the state of the Republican Party, which did not go over well within the party also. And Republicans, many Republicans are angry at him. They are saying that they're unable to raise money at the level that they could in the RNC. Some are withholding their money because they want Michael Steele out. He is deeply embattled. He was interviewed on ABC News Radio, and he basically said that to his detractors within his party, they need to shut up. Day before yesterday, Michael Steele was deeply embattled within his own party, and Harry Reid's comments were a gift to him, and he is exploiting that gift. But it does not for one second overshadow not only Michael Steele's own gaffe, but the very deep trouble he's in within the Republican Party.
Shirley Eiffel, it is always a pleasure to have you on the airwaves with us, and we'll look forward to talking about your other piece as soon as we can, because I really do want to tackle that one as well. And
I do. Thanks so much. It was great talking to you guys.
Enjoy tonight.
Take care, Shirley.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
You know, Mark, this idea that Shirley just talked about Michael Steele being in trouble, you and I, we're really going to have to take a look at that, because he is under fire. A great deal of Republican staffers, the senior staffers on the House and the Senate, had a conference call where they essentially said to the RNC senior staff, he either needs to watch what he says or go. And he was made a very honest assessment. He thinks that the Republicans will not take control of the House and Senate in the 2010 elections, the elections that are coming up. Now, he has since revised those remarks. And now he says, yes, we're going to win back the House, win back the Senate. Unlikely. But he is in a great deal of trouble and seems to have been in trouble since he became chairperson.
He does put his foot in his mouth a lot. Whew. But what he said about, if he had nuanced what he said.
You're right.
About not taking back the House and the Senate, and talk about forging ahead and gaining seats.
That's right.
And continuing the fight for
and build
America
and
that
build.
They believe
That's
in.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Then you know it's kind of how he does what he does. You know, I mean he's the one who came up with the Republican National Convention with Drill Baby Drill.
That's right.
And they gave it to Giuliani instead. But he's the one who actually
he's
did it first.
The one that did it. That's right. I remember that.
You know, he can't even get credit for things he does right for them.
Poor guy.
You know? Anyway, we have to take a very short break. We'll be right back. We're going to switch gears and look at the mortgage crisis facing Marylanders and Americans and what is being done about it. It is a very serious crisis. 2.4 million more folks will go into foreclosure this coming year. And one-third of all homeowners are underwater because their home is worth less now than when they bought their home. So stay with us for that. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite welcomes the new decade with its second annual Breakthroughs issue, highlighting 10 simple ideas that could change the city. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. We'll be right back.